in Beverly Hills. We are
Hello,
Zikre
all,
Hashum.
and welcome to the Chaburah. Tonight we have with us our Rosh Beit Midrash, Senior Rabbi of the Sephardian Portuguese Communities, Rabbi Joseph Dweck, for a special question and answer session. You all have an opportunity of sending in questions via the portal on our website, and we are excited to have the Rav answer and explore them with us. Thank you all for joining us live. Thank you all who'll be joining us afterwards. Rabbi, it's always a privilege to have you with us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rav Ohad. The privilege is mine. Okay, so we've got questions. I have printed out. I'm not answering all of the questions because some I felt were just not right for this particular setting, and some I didn't really understand, to be honest, were not clear enough for me. So I apologize for that. But I'm going to try and get through as many of them as possible, the great majority of them, I hope. We'll be able to do this, I think, until 9:30, and then I have to end. So I'm just going to go in order, no particular order. I mean, it is a particular order. I'm going to go from the first question to the last question that I got in the order that I received them. I'm not mentioning names. I'm just reading the questions, if that's okay. So the first question is, what is the Hacham's personal? I imagine he means me, but I don't like when people talk to me in third person. I was like, who are you talking about? Who are you talking about? What is the personal perspective, my personal perspective, when it comes to academic biblical criticism? Is it something to be dismissed outright? Is there any truth to it? And what would be the classical Sephardi approach to this question? So I'll answer the last thing first. There is no classical Sephardi approach to this question. The classical Sephardi approach to this question didn't know from this. So the entire, approach would be anything that goes against the validity of the Torah's coming to Moshe through Nevuah is going to be invalid and not looked at. But in terms of this question, to me, is it to be dismissed outright? It depends what you're dismissing. I wouldn't say to dismiss it out completely outright, because there's been plenty of things that biblical criticism has come to an awareness of that enhances and enlightens the text, right? I mean, it brings a greater context and awareness of kind of, the nature of the time that the text is speaking about, and the mores and so on and so forth that apply to it. But other than that, I don't study it. I mean, I really don't pay any attention to it at all, personally. I hear what people tell me about it, which, when I hear something interesting, I include it. I say, well, that's interesting, and maybe it's something that I include, or maybe it's not. But it's not something that is, if the question is that it should we worry about it undermining the general understanding of our emunah with regards to what the Torah is. Yes, I mean, nothing should undermine the general emunah of what it is, that how it is that we understand Torah and how we always have, meaning in terms of its principle that it's given to Moshe Rabbeinu, and that's the nature of the Nevuah. That I don't toy around with. Number two, how can we understand the way that Rambam uses Pesukim in Mishneh Torah in ways that differ from the Drashot Chazal made in the Talmud? What is Rambam's methodology? I really don't know what you mean specifically by this, right? I mean, there's no reason at all that Rambam, when you're saying Drashot, I'm not sure what you mean by Drashot. You're talking about Halachic Drashot, talking about Agadic Drashot. It's not so clear to me what it is that you're talking about. If you're talking about that the Rambam would use a different Pasuk in order to be able to learn a mitzvah than the Hachamim are. There's all different things. Rambam explained Mishnayot differently than Talmud did in various places. Not many, in a few places, but nonetheless. So I'm not 100% sure with re regards to this question what you mean. So I apologize, I can't answer that. The third question is, after finding the different opinions on Hashgacha Pratit, I don't know what you mean by finding the different opinions, what would be an advice to practically deal with this day to day? I'm not also I'm not sure. Again, the language of the question is all I have to go by over here. So when it says after finding the different opinions on Hashgacha Pratit, I understand this person is probably translating into English, because English is not their native language. I'm going to say this: if you're understanding Rambam's approach to Hashgacha Pratit, I can answer that question. But when you talk about different approaches to Hashgacha Pratit, which approaches, right? I'm not sure. So I only teach Rambam's approach, and I only live by Rambam's approach. So I can answer it with regards to that, if that helps you in whatever way it might. And with regards to that, Rambam's approach is that Hashgacha Pratit has everything to do with your consciousness of God. right? How it is that you know God. And so that's what you have to work on. In other words, the more that a person's mind is on God, the more that a person is training oneself to think about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to engage with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to consider the acts of his every day and every moment in terms of his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, nothing less. And a person is training oneself towards that, the greater the Hashgaha. And so it's not an on or off switch. It's all a question of the degree to which a person is capable of doing that and able to do that. And it, you know, if a person is working on that every day, every month, every year, for many years, it enhances, right? There may be two steps forward and one step back with regards to it. It's not a straight line, and it's not something that just happens, you know, automatically. It's a struggle. It's an up and down struggle. There are many, many wrenches that are thrown into it. And you see, I mean, you know, all you have to do is read the Nevi'im, and you see the Nevi'im themselves struggled with regards to their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and what HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked of them and how it was that they had to deal with it and so on and so forth. And if the Nevi'im are like that, al ahad kama v'chama, how much more so we have to be concerned about that. So the advice that I give with regards to that is Shiviti Adonai l'negdi tamid. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be in front of you always. Start there. First, just get God in front of you. Once you get him in front of you, then you can consider really how it is that you're acting regularly in front of him. Yeah, and how it is that your behavior is. And that's what has to do, that's the Hashgacha. All right, this question will affect a later question that comes up with regards to prayer, but nonetheless, that's what I would say with regards to that. Number five. There's a person who wrote a very long intro to a question and then asked, given its emphasis on principles and illustrious history that has its roots in Sfarad, what is the role of Lamdanut? Which I'm not sure what that is, the conceptual approach to learning in the Chabura Weltanschauung. So, with regards to that, I would simply say I wrote my master's thesis on this, and I used Harambam and Chacham David Nieto and the Ramchal as models for this, if I understand the question appropriately. So, I would direct you to reading that, and you can find that online at the S&P website. And if you have problem finding it there, contact us and we'll get it
Good
to you.
image.
We'll get it to you. All right. Number six. What should one study first in its entirety? Shisha Sidre Mishnah or Mishneh Torah? Tanakh. Tanakh should be the first thing that you study. It's the most important thing, and that's everything else is based on that. So that's number one. And with regards to that, I would say Shnayim Mikra V'Echad Targum. People don't do that. And that is very clearly a halakha. I mean, everybody, the Gemara clearly states that it's a halakha, that everybody's obligated to do. The Harambam posek that it's a halakha, that everybody's obligated to do. And nobody does it. I shouldn't say nobody, some people do it. But do that, right? So that's the first thing that I would say is your Mikra studied, right? Before you kind of look at the Mishnah or the Mishneh Torah. The second thing is with regards to the Mishnah and the Mishneh Torah, it really depends on what your goal is. But I would say, as a general answer, Mishnah, because the Mishnah, the Harambam is based on the Mishnah. Everything is based on the Mishnah. So, if you want to be a Talmid Chacham, or if you want to at least have good base in terms of understanding Torah Sheba'al Peh, you have to know the Mishnah. Right? It's very, very important because everything is based on that. As I mean, and I'll say, you know, there's no comparison to studying Harambam, the Mishneh Torah, without the Mishnah. And studying the Mishneh Torah, having studied the Mishnah, it's a completely different book. You understand completely differently. You have a much clearer and better understanding of it. So I would probably say the best thing to do if you want to embark on such a thing is to study the Mishnah with the Pirush of Rambam on the Mishnah, which he did on purpose, right? He expected that people should study the Mishnah, and he did that in order to be able to consolidate or distill the discussions of the Gemara on the Mishnah, but you should be able to recognize the Mishnah and learn the Mishnah. So you have a better base with studying the Mishnah. Yeah, I mean, it's true that a person studies Mishneh Torah, that he has all of Kol HaTorah Kula, and you know, you have your entire life, please God, on Me'avir Shana to be able to do that. But if you're asking what you do first, what you focus on, I would definitely say the Mishnah. How to study Moreh Nebuchim with a teacher. Number seven, how did the Rambam understand karet? I like this question very much. I like this person particularly asked to redact their name, but I have to say that I like this question very much. How did the Rambam understand karet? And where did he learn his opinion from? Does it really mean their soul is destroyed? Right? So there's an assumption in that question, obviously. So I'm going to ask a favor. Where's Rambam? Do we have Rambam in here somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay. We can get Mada, and if I can get the Perusha Mishnah and Nizikin, I don't know if we have it. I would appreciate it. Okay, so I understand. I imagine that what you're referring to is Rambam's treatment of Karet in Hilchot Teshuvah. Right, so Rambam writes about Karet in several places of Hilchot Teshuvah, and he says this is Hadar. So, and he says in Hilchot Teshuvah as follows. He says in Perek Chet of Hilchot Teshuvah, in Halakha Vav. No, excuse me, this is not. The letters are a little off here. Hold on a second. Okay. In Halakha He. Hanikama she'en nekama gedola mimena, Rambam says. Nekama, meaning the literally translated as revenge, but it means negative response, right? What the punishment, essentially. That is the greatest of all, the worst possible thing that can happen to a person. Shetikaret hanefesh. That the nefesh will be cut out, cut down, and not be zochet to that hayim. What's hayim? Olam Haba. Right. So Rambam is in the middle of a discussion of Olam Haba. In Perek Chet, he opens Perek Chet with Hatovat Tzfunah LeTzadikim, and so on and so forth. Talks about Olam Haba. So he goes, the worst possible thing that can happen for a person is that they're cut out of that Olam Haba. They don't have any access to Olam Haba. Shneemar, as it says in the pasuk, ki karet ti karet ha nefesh ahi avonah ba. As it says in the pasuk, this soul will be cut out doubly, hikaret, tikaret, right? It's double language, which is verily, right? Surely, the person will be cut out. Avonah ba, the avon is in it. Now, that's a pasuk from, now, where does Rambam base this from? He bases it in Gemara and Sanhedrin, Tzaddik. Right? It's very clear, Gemara and Sanhedrin. But it says here, in the, he quotes this pasuk, hikaret, tikaret, and nefesh ahi. Right? This nefesh is hikaret. Hachamim say, and Rambam quotes it, they learned hikaret ba'olam hazeh, hikaret la'olam haba. Right, so the karet occurs to a person in this olam, whatever that is. What does that mean? Hikaret ba'olam hazeh, hikaret la'olam haba. I have a shita on that, but nonetheless, what is this pasuk in Bemidbar? This pasuk in Bemidbar is talking about a blasphemer, right? And it says devar Adonai baza. Right, this person belittled and completely degraded the word of God. It's very severe. Very severe. It's not every karet. But Rambam writes over here, this karet, zeh ha'ovdan, this horrible, worst possible punishment that a person can experience that they speak about is that a person loses olam. Now, there's a problem here. Why? Because everybody thinks that the Rambam, this is his definition of karet. And that any time that it says that there's karet in the Torah, this is what it means. You eat chametz on Pesach, karet. No olam haba, right? You, a person is over arayot, karet. No olam haba. A person mechalel Shabbat b'mezid, karet. No olam haba. And I think that that's not true. I think from based on Harambam, it's not true. Harambam here, I'll explain to you why, which is why I like this question, right? Because it gave an opportunity for me to present this to you. Harambam here says, the worst possible thing that can happen to a person is this kind of karet. What kind of karet? That they are locked out of Olam Haba. Now, in another place, Rambam writes, Gimel, if I'm not mistaken. He talks about the people in Perigima, right? Who are all these people in Perigima? Apikorsin, minim, right? People that are kofir be'ikar, right? They reject the very basis of the Emunah of Israel. He says here, Elohen she'en la'im chaylik ela nichratin ve'ovdin v'nidonim al golded rish'am v'hatatam le'olam u'olme olamim. They are cut down and lost. And notice the last word, nidonim. They're judged. Yeah? on the severity of the resha of their evil or their iniquity or their wickedness forever, forever. La'olam. That's what it says. Then there's one more place where Rambam writes that when a person receives karet, they are nichratim kebehema, right? They drop dead like a behema. So all of these elements of karet, I'm going to suggest, right? And I have proof for this. All of these elements of karet are the worst elements of karet. They're not the only elements of karet. How do I know that? Why do I have basis for that? I'll show you in a minute why I have basis for that. But I believe that Harambam, when he writes this karet, that it is the worst possible punishment that a person gets, is talking only about the karet that applies to the minim and apikorsim. Not to a person who ate chametz on Pesach. Not to a person who is over any of the other averot of the Torah that is karet, mechalel Shabbat, ovrei arayot, and so on and so forth. Why do I think that? Because this. Harambam.
No, it's don't
Zilov. Oh, it's Hagnaot Berachedek. Okay, it's good. Okay, so yeah, perfect. So it says over here in the Pirusha Mishnah, Hara'a Gemurai Hachratata Nevesh Beobdana. The worst thing, no, this is not what I want. Where's the, this is the Yesodot. Yeah. So not used to this. Oh, yeah. Is this Rav Kahar's translation? Did they use Rav Kahar? Huh? Maybe Chafu. I. Printing. Okay. Okay, so listen to it. So at the end of the Yesodot of the 13 Ikarim, Harambam says, now, if there's a person who believes in these Ikarim, right? Person accepts these Ikarim as true and lives their life faithfully to these Ikarim, they are Bichlal Yisrael. So when it says, Kol Yisrael, Yeshlem Chelek Le'olam Haba, they're included. Even if, afilu asa kol shehu yachol min averot. Even if he did any one of the averot in the Torah, anyone, doesn't say which averot, no, the karet averot, any one of the averot, mehamat ha-ta'ava v'itgabrut ha-teva garua, because he was weak. He had it, and he was enticed. Whatever it was, he was weak. He couldn't get over his yetzer hara. Oh, he's punished to the severity of the sin of whatever it was he transgressed. But he has chelik. Why? Because it says Kol Yisrael Yeshem. What makes Israel or not Israel with regards to this? The acceptance of the Inkarim. Okay. He's one of the rebels of Israel, but he's an Israeli rebel. He's not outside the cloud. Which tells you very clearly that even the averot sheyesh bahem karet, hareu michlal poshei Yisrael beyesh toheret nidon. He's judged. However, it is that he's judged based on his context, his issues, his real. And the only one who knows that is Harambam writes in Hilchot Teshuvah El Deot. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows how to deal with your zechuyot and avonot and so on and so forth. Who is not bichlal Yisrael? Who doesn't accept these Ikarim? They're not bichlal Yisrael. Right, so Rambam says, "Im nitrofev la'adam yesod me'ele yesodot hare yatzah min ha'kelal." They are no longer part of the kelal, which means that they are no longer part of Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek le'olam haba. That's why Rambam says the worst karet that a person experiences is getting locked out of olam haba. And how do you get locked out of olam haba? You're a minor apikoros, and you reject one of these, or some of these, or all of these, Has Shalom, these Ikarim of the Torah. You hear? Now, more to be based on that is because Harambam writes that clearly based on the Darshan Chazal, it says, Hikaret, Hikaret. He karet ba'alamazet, he karet ba'alamaba. If you just told me that the worst karet is alamaba, and that's what karet is, then what's he karet ba'alamazet? What does that mean? All right. So my understanding that he karet ba'alamazet means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates to you as though you are cut off while you're alive in this world. Which means the relationship of Shamayim to you is that you are not bichlal. But you always have an opportunity to re-engage bichlal as long as you're alive. And if you die, not bichlal, so then you're nidon, you're judged, kefi godel chet'o, and then you have a chelek and olam haba. The only way you lose a chelek and olam haba is if you're not miposhei Yisrael, but you are a kofer or a min or not bikoros. How do you become a kofer, a min or bikoros? You reject one of the 13 ikarim. You hear? So that is the meaning of it. And even with regards to that, for the questioner, right, the soul is never destroyed. The soul is not destroyed. The soul is now. This is the one thing that I don't know the answer to. I'll be honest, I really don't know the answer to it. When Harambam says Nidon, that he is judged, le'olam, I don't understand that. I get what he's saying. I mean, I understand. I know what he means, but I don't understand what he means. Because I don't understand the point of that. I don't get how it fits within to the whole philosophical issue. What is the point of causing a soul to suffer for all eternity? Sounds very Christian. Right. So I'm not saying that it's not what Harambam wrote. I just don't understand. So I tell you, in all honesty, I have no idea what it means. And even if it is to be taken at face value, I don't understand the purpose of it. I don't get how it helps anything. Or how it fixes anything, or how it's beneficial to anything, except just, what do you call it? Sadistic, desires for suffering, which of course, Chas V'Shalom, we would never say about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I don't get it.
Sounds like a ton of damnation.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. I hate to believe that that's what it is. So I don't understand. I will figure it out. I just don't get it. Yeah.
Well, that applies to certain types of karma, but there's the worst types of karma that you described,
Yeah.
which are enochelikvara.
Right, which means that after one dies as an apikoros and has not done teshuvah, there's no opportunity. The death is not a kapara for them. For a person who has karet, death is a kapara for that person, right? So then they have to deal with the judgment, and whatever it is that comes. That might not have addressed or taken care of, and so on and so forth.
What is our understanding of the meaning of not having a chelek olam haba? What happens to that soul?
So Harambam says, that's what I'm trying to say. I don't understand the actual meaning of it, but it says that the soul is punished and suffers essentially. It's punished for all eternity. Le'olam, which is a long time. I don't know what that means. But I will say in caveat, I just gave a, I taught, I just finished this a series or whatever in the teaching the Montefiore Kollel, rabbinic students, the Ikarim. And the last shiur I gave was on heresy, right? And it's very clear that Harambam, at the end of his life, changed all of the things that he wrote on heresy. And Rav Kafich writes this. We can see, Rav Kafich says, we can see from his handwriting because we can tell the difference between his young handwriting and his old handwriting, which is true. Chacham Obadiah could tell the difference between his young handwriting and his old handwriting. I could absolutely tell the difference. It changed as he got older. And he said that Harambam, in all of the places that he brings in this concept of Tinok Shenishba, right, that because he writes so harshly and severely against the Apikorsim, right? You can see any time Harambam really could not stomach people that rejected the Ikarim. He couldn't stomach them. And he writes very, very, I mean, I didn't even read to you, but he writes here. We don't have a lot of time, so I'll read it to you. It's very harsh. Anyway, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's very harsh, right? Very, very, very harsh. It's probably in my, I mean, I don't have the full, knowledge of all of it, but in my mind, it is probably one of the harshest, if not the harshest, writing on Harambam I've ever seen. Right? So he says that you have to, if there's somebody who even hesitates in their acceptance of the 13 Ikarim, you have to hate them and run after them and destroy them and make sure to kill them. Right? And anyone can kill them. You don't have to kill them by war. You're going to any of that. The first one who kills him, better. Like hard, you can imagine what it could create, in a society. So when he writes it in Mishneh Torah, he adds this thing about Tinok Shenishba. He says that's only if the person who believes this brought it out in his own mind. Nobody was talking about it around them. They never heard such a thing around them. The society that they're living in was devout and connected and believed in it. And this guy decides to come up with that guy. But a person who was raised this way or lived in a society was talking this way and so on. They're like a baby that was taken captive by the Goyim. And you can't fault that child for believing what it is. Even if, he says, even if they end up finding out that they're Jewish, end up living with Jews afterwards, learning about their thing. Well, they've already been painted. It's very, very difficult for them to uproot the foundations of everything they learned when they were children. They don't have the deen of any of this, and the mitzvah is to bring them back in Tishu B'Av. And that's it. So there's a question, right? Are they still considered apikorsim, even they're apikorsim by accident? And there's this discussion with regards to that, but it seems like Rambam makes a very big difference between that. But all of those things he added at the end of his life. So there was a thing going on with the Karaim. Because Rambam couldn't stand them either. And he recognized that there was a whole movement in which the younger members of this movement were really not at fault for what they believed, because they were taught, they were just taught badly, falsely. Okay, next question. Good question. What does it mean when Elijah reveals himself to someone? For example, in the very beginning of Perkei Derbi Eliezer, we are told that Rabbi Eliezer fasted for 2 weeks until Eliyahu became revealed to him. What does this mean? It means Eliyahu came to him. I don't know why that's so complicated. It's very simple. Eliyahu, we believe, never died. Right? The Hachamim say explicitly that he never died. His neshama is around. He became a malach. He's the only human that went from human to malach. And why shouldn't it be that Malach can't communicate with a human being? The Gemara talks about it. You don't need Perkei Derbi Eliezer. The Gemara talks about it. It says that one of the Hachamim, a person was mauled by a lion within Arba Amot of this Hacham. And it says that Eliyahu didn't speak to him for 3 days because this happened in the proximity of the Hacham, that he didn't want to talk to him for 3 days. He wouldn't come to him. Hachamim talk about it. I don't know why that's such a big deal. Okay. The men of the Great Assembly authored the basic text of the daily prayer. That is true. The middle portion is dedicated to us asking for our needs. Also true. When I ask and I do not receive, why should the logical conclusion not be that there is no use in prayer? Well, I would say with the greatest of respect that that is a very arrogant conclusion to come to. There have been times that what I want occurs without my asking for it, and there have been times that it doesn't, even though I did ask for it. Why, after the above fact, should I continue to pray? Well, the first thing I will say is, why would you assume that just because you asked for something that you get it? Right? Well, you can answer to me because there's a pasuk that says, "Terem yikra'u v'ani ane." Before they even finished calling out to me, I'll already answer them. So there is reason to assume that if I ask for something, that the Rosh Baruch Hu should answer, right? Now, the first thing I'll say is that's with regards to Am Yisrael praying with all of their heart as a people, right? As a genuine group, right? They come together and they pray with all of their heart. But there's reason to assume that a faithful member of Am Yisrael that is dedicated and connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be able to rely on the same kind of thing. The thing that we should not be presumptuous about is that how do you even know that you're standing in front of the Shekhinah when you pray? How do you know that you're even standing in front of God and talking to God when you pray? So that's why I say there's a bit of an arrogant assumption with that. And I don't mean that in any insulting way to the person who asked the question in any way, by any means. I'm just simply calling it out, right? We all say arrogant things and do arrogant things, myself included, unfortunately, more than I wish to recognize. But that's the reality. We believe things that are a little bit arrogant, sometimes a lot bit arrogant, because we assume that because I am saying words that sound like prayer, that I'm praying. And that's wrong. More often than not, we are not praying. Because in order to pray, you have to be able to stand in front of Shekhinah. In order to stand in front of Shekhinah, you need Kavanah. And in order to have Kavanah, you have to clear your mind of all other things and be able to genuinely stand before what you experience and hope is the Shekhinah. And even with all of that, You have absolutely no control over HaKadosh Baruch Hu's manifestation before you or not. You hope that he manifests before you. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, even with all of that, who says that what you're asking is good for you? Maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu's answer is no. And that's also a possibility. So take into consideration that even if you are praying absolutely and completely, which I would say is highly dubious and questionable, that what you're asking for is something that is appropriate for you to receive. That's the second thing that I would say. And why should you continue praying? Because building relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is valuable in and of itself. We don't just pray in order to be able to get the things that we want. We pray to be able to commune with him. And the things that we ask for are in the development of that relationship. But remember that the opening of Tefillah is speaking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in recognition of him. And that is extremely important for us in our lives, that we genuinely strive to be able to connect. And that's why I said it goes back to the original question about Ashkaha that was asked. And Tefillah is a very important part of it. So that's how I would answer that. It's my number. So the next question is, if, for example, both Rambam and Rashi were divinely inspired, quote unquote, when authoring their respective works, why is it that they reach different, sometimes antithetical conclusions? How is both these and those the words of the living God an actual answer? It seems like a cop-out. Well, the first thing that I will say is, I think there's an assumption here about what divinely inspired means. Right? I think there's a misunderstanding, perhaps, of what Ruach HaKodesh is. Ruach HaKodesh is not Nebuah. Ruach HaKodesh is not God talking to somebody. Or, for that matter, God even giving information to somebody. Ruach HaKodesh is simply the openness to a greater level of consciousness that is not natural in the way that we are, without some relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? Some connection involved with it. So it is an enhancement of my own view of the world, my own recognition and understanding of things, and that tapping into higher levels of reality that are significant, right? And for that matter, could be considered quite substantial in terms of the reality of the nature of these things. Why should these and those are the words of the living God be a cop-out? That I don't know. I don't know why that's a problem. I think that it's quite parochial to expect that what is true is so black and white and only and monolithic. We recognize that truths, first of all, have a great deal to do with the perspectives from which something is seen. And it is absolutely possible to be able to see an objective reality from very different perspectives and be able to describe those perspectives in ways that seem quite antithetical to each other. There's no question about that. It just takes a bit more of a sophisticated understanding of the nature of reality. And so therefore, we have an ability to be able to describe reality from considerably different perspectives that in some cases can seem antithetical to each other because they're coming from such different places, but nonetheless very valuable and important to be able to have them in order to be able to have a more robust description of the nature of reality. Right? So it doesn't matter, you know, if you ask an engineer to describe a situation, and you ask an artist or a business person or whatever to describe a situation, they're going to describe situations not just from different perspectives, from fundamentally different frameworks. They're going to focus on things that are very, very different than the other person focuses on. Right? These are ideas of mental models. So depending on how it is that you, the lens through which you see reality is going to determine tremendously how you define and describe reality, which will sound ostensibly quite antithetical to the way another person would define reality. And all Ruach HaKodesh is an enhancement of my own personal view and lens of the world through tapping into higher levels of consciousness, right? More, if you want to say, for lack of a better term, divine levels of consciousness. According to our sages, the book of Ruth can be summed up in one word, conversion. Is that true? I don't know. Don't remember that. But nonetheless, I can understand why one would say that. Hence, it is read aloud in synagogues on Shavuot, in Ashkenazi synagogues, not in Sephardi synagogues. Sephardim don't read it publicly. when we essentially all converted by entering the covenant on Shavuot, I see, right? Furthermore, the book of Jonah likewise can be summarized in just one word, repentance. Hence, it is read aloud on Yom Kippur. Now, my question is, given that Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, is read on Sukkot, not publicly amongst the Sfaradim, it's read not at all amongst the Sfaradim, except by me. How would you, if you had to summarize the book in one word, existentialism? That's how I would. Next question. What is the best way to get a good understanding of the Peshat and the Chumash if my Hebrew isn't great yet? Is it better to try to become as fluent as possible in Hebrew or rely on translations? It's a good question. Look, relying on translations is always a problem. But reading Hebrew is also a problem because people assume that they understand Hebrew because they're able to order falafel in Yerushalayim. And that's not true, right? A person has to be able to understand the Lashon HaKodesh in order to be able to study the Chumash. So look, there's no question about the fact that I would say to everybody, you must learn Lashon HaKodesh. If you want to study Torah, you have to learn Lashon HaKodesh. You cannot understand Torah properly without learning Lashon HaKodesh. Harambam writes on Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, it says, Heve mehashev mitzvah kala kebahamura. You have to be careful about measuring. Don't measure a light mitzvah against a severe mitzvah or a heavy mitzvah. You don't know. You don't know what rewards you get for the mitzvah. So Harambam says, mitzvah kala, what is a minor or a light mitzvah? Limidat Lashon HaKodesh. Learning Lashon HaKodesh. And I used to say that to my Hebrew teachers in the school, because every now and then I would ask my Hebrew, you know, my Hebrew teachers felt that they didn't, I would ask the Torah teachers to teach Hebrew language, because I had Israeli Torah teachers, and I would ask them every now and then to teach a Hebrew language class, and they would protest. Like, I'm teaching Torah, and I would show them, mitzvah kala, limidat Lashon HaKodesh. And they couldn't really say anything, so they're good. But that's the first thing I would say, right? So you must do that. Everybody who values Torah has to spend time learning Lashon HaKodesh. You can't get by with art scroll or any of the other things, right? That's number one. Number two, until you do, you should strive to find the best translations that you can. And that's very hard. It's very, very difficult. How do I know what the best translation is? You're always, always losing something in translation. Always, right? You're not reading the native text, which is why in our school also, we taught the text in the language of the text. So all of the classes were taught in Hebrew. So it wasn't just reading the text in Hebrew. We taught this, we spoke in Hebrew in the classes, right? Because there are nuances. There's minor nuances and grammatical changes in words that make all the difference in the world that you can't do in English. It's just a word. Right, you can't. You don't get the sense of the entire thrust of the language because the whole language is based on roots and letters. Right, the connection of letters and the contextual presentation of the word. So, if I give you the word samech peresh on its own, how do you read that word? Sefer, sapa, siper, sofer. How do you read the word? You can't read the word, is the answer. The only way you could possibly read the word is the presentation of the word in its context. And then you could read the word, which is why the Torah does not have dots, right? Because appropriately, it shouldn't have dots. You should know how the word is to be pronounced and spoken based on its contextual presentation. That's how you read it. English is not like English. The word is the word. There it is. What do you do? So that's completely lost in reading and understanding and how the whole thing is presented to us, right? Because that's part of the conscious engagement with the text. Okay, so you can do that. So then getting a good translation is the next best thing. And Harambam does write, he writes this to Obadiah Ger, because Obadiah Ger asked Harambam to translate, it's very cute, he asked Harambam to translate the Mishneh Torah into Arabic. Because he was a Ger, he was Arabic, right? He spoke Arabic. And Harambam didn't say, what are you, crazy? I'm going to translate. It took me 400 years to write the book. I'm going to translate the whole book. He doesn't speak like that thing. He speaks to Ger with such care, such rahmanut, such patience, right? Harambam, he used to write, you know, you could see in the Geniza, right in Cambridge. Nobody had paper. They had paper. Harambam would get an answer, a question, right? He would write the answer on the same paper that he got the question and send it back to the person. He didn't have to, couldn't go get, you don't get like a ream of paper from Costco and write back. That's how he wrote. So he did. And he would write one line, Bechatab Moshe. Two lines, right? Whatever it was, Bechatab Moshe. This he writes to Obadiah Gir. He writes it, kacha, a whole letter, carefully explaining to him, answering every single question he asks. And on this question, he says, look, I wish that I could write it. I'm sorry that I could. I don't have the ability. I don't have time to be able to translate the entire thing. I'm so sorry. He goes, but, you know, I know some people are trying to translate it. If you can try, try to learn the Lashon HaKodesh. But then he says to him, he goes, the main thing is knowing what it says. Know what the information is. That's the most important thing, not the words, right? Not the words, right? Okay. So what I said beforehand is notwithstanding, that still stands. But nonetheless, the next best thing is to find a very good translation. And you have to see what the best translations are. I don't want to recommend one over the other. I would say to start with Everett Fox. Everett Fox. Everett Fox doesn't read like the King James Bible, but you definitely feel the Hebrew syntax in his translation, and is very pshat oriented. And I think it's a very, very good where place to start for you. For
this one, should start with biblical Hebrew or modern Hebrew?
Sorry,
they're learning Hebrew. Should one start with biblical Hebrew or modern?
If their goal is to study Torah, right, and even Gemara. I mean, look, Gemara, you're stuck with Aramaic, right? So you have to learn the Aramaic. But to learn Mishnah and Torah and Mishnah. Mishnah is a different Hebrew than the Mishnah of Torah, but it's enough. If a person learns the Hebrew of Torah, they'll be able to more or less understand the Mishnah. I would say that the biblical Hebrew is the most important. Because once you learn that, you have Tanakh, you're able to read Tanakh. And you have the core and the source. What is your personal favorite book or account found in the Bible? Meaning, not your favorite. What do you find yourself coming back to or thinking about most? I don't. In all honesty, I don't have a favorite, and I don't find one thing that I keep coming back to most. It really has everything to do with what it is that I'm focusing on in that particular time, in that particular year, in that particular period of my life. It was a conversation I had with Rabbi Sachs, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Alav Shalom. And he said, you know, I was saying to him, you know, I'm noticing things in the Mikra that I never noticed. And he said, that always happens. He goes, I'm recognizing things in the text now, and, you know, at my age in my 60s that I never paid attention to in my 20s or 30s. I couldn't even pick it up. I wasn't even seeing it in the text until I came to this point of life and I had gone through these elements of life, and suddenly I'm seeing things from text because of where I am in life. So I don't really have a favorite. There's some great things that I always enjoy, but there's several, many of them, too many to. You, Ken. Which Bible commentator is your personal favorite? I also don't have one. I really don't. It all depends on what I'm looking for, who has something that's really lifting and enlightening. I have some beautiful Perush of the Seforno. I said this in Parashashi the other day. The Seforno on Tehillim, which is hard to find. It's not available. I found it in a... They published it in... They published it. They published it in... Torat Chaim, you know, the Torat Chaim has also on Tehillim, so they put it in the Tehillim, and I found it online. And he writes, we say every day in the Tahanunim, Sfaradim anyway, Perek Kafhev Tehillim, Hatot Ne'orai Ufsha'aya Tizkor, right? The Hatayim of my youth, which is the Pshat of the Pasuk, Hatot Ne'orai, the Hatayim, the sins of my youth, Al Tizkor. Don't look at, don't remember God, don't look at them, right? Because, you know, chances are when I was younger, I was less careful, and so on and so on. What does Sforno say? Sforno says beautifully. He says, "Hatot neorai, yetzer lev ha'adam ra min orav." That the inclination or the creative inclinations of a person is ra. It's bad from youth. Ve'ba'ubaze hatati im batsheva. And it's from that that I sinned with batsheva. That's the Sforno saying. Well, how old was David when he sinned with batsheva? He wasn't a kid. He wasn't a teenager. He was the king of Israel already by that time. He had his last son with her, right, with Bathsheba. So what is the Sforno saying? Sforno is saying, in me is this thing that I have from my youth. And essentially what it's saying is that there is a child self inside that is responsible for what I'm doing right now, that's been with me from early life. And that he's saying, Tavishwa, Al Tizkor. It's fascinating. Yes. Anyway, that happens to be that particular thing. That was on that day. The Sephorno was my favorite. My favorite bit. Okay. Okay. What does it mean that prophecy has been taken away from the prophets and given to madmen and children? That's a good question, right? So it says, "Miyom shenehara bet hamikdash nitna nebuah l'shoptim v'latinukot." From the time the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, nebuah was taken away from the nebiim and given to madmen and children. How do I understand that? I understand that as follows. The problem with the nebuah at that time was that we had developed such obstructions psychologically to God, right? Because we had relinquished, ironically, we had relinquished Avodah Zarah. Right. When does Nebuah essentially stop? It stops from the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, for all intents and purposes. So already after Purim, which is at the beginning of the second Beit HaMikdash, so we're talking about a period of about 4.5 centuries, which is not a small amount of time, right? Longer than Jews have been in this country, since the S&P came in and established Judaism in this country. It's only 350 years, right? So it's another 100 years. But nonetheless, what is going on during that time? We're weaning ourselves, right, off of the Magic Kingdom. And we're coming into a very, a much more rationalistic, much more earthy, much more pragmatic way of dealing with life and with God, right? So Purim's entire lesson to us was that you do not need God to be doing miracles in order for you to be able to see God and know God and for you to be able to be related to him in the world. And that is how the whole second Beit HaMikdash runs. Second Beit HaMikdash doesn't have any of the special magic stuff that goes on in the first Beit HaMikdash, Hachamim say. It's much more boring than the first Beit HaMikdash. And by the time the second Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, we don't have any Nevi'im anymore. The last Nevi'im are the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, Haggai, Malachi, and Zechariah. So what happens after them in all of that period? That period, we are more rationalistic thinkers. All of a sudden, you have people who start saying things like the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, right? And Pirkei Avot, Hema, B'vush, Oshad, Devari. Before them, nobody had anything to say. Seriously, nobody had anything to say. The only ones that had anything to say were the Nevi'im, and what they said was what God said, not what they said. They just formatted it in their language. But that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. So all of a sudden, when you start having actual human beings think about things and talk about things and engage in things, from the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah and on, and then from there you have the entire thing of Avot, Nachamim, and so on. But at the same time, as a result of that, we become the gods. So we are no longer worshiping external gods. We become the gods. If we're not Hachamim, being very, very careful. And so there were obstructions that did not allow for us to be able to be completely batel and allow for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to speak to us. Because people, the Gemara says this explicitly in Masechet Sukkah. It says that when we lost the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, in its potency, right, in its high throttle levels, we also lost our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Gemara says something beautiful, very, very, very fundamentally important. It says you cannot cut things down halfway. So once you take away that Yetzer Hara, you take away the Yetzer Hara, not for Avodah Zarah, you take away the Yetzer Hara for Avodah. Because there's never a Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. There's a Yetzer for Avodah. You channel it into Avodah Zarah. That you do. Right? So if you want to take that, and they went, it says they fasted for days to find the source of the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, and so on and so forth. Where did they find it? Finally they found it. It came out from where? The Kodesh of Kodeshim. And they killed it because they couldn't handle it anymore. So with that becomes a loss of our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why it also says, Nifsika Chomad Barzel. From the time the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Nifsika Chomad Barzel bin Yisrael Lavim Shebashamayim. An iron curtain went up. Now you think Churchill thought he was the originator of that term. An iron curtain went up between Israel and God. So we had obstructions in terms of our own psyche, our own consciousness, and what we were dealing with, that did not allow us to simply be able to be vessels of Nebuah. The only ones who didn't have that problem were children and nutheads. Because children are not conscious enough and not self-absorbed enough in order to be able to have that problem. And nor are lunatics. Right? They are taken over by their thoughts, not controllers of their thoughts. And because they don't have that control, they are also incidentally open to possible experiences of Nebuah and communication. So that is how I would answer that question.
Wait a second. Isn't that removing the positive aspect? Because there is a positive aspect, right, of like the rationalization and saying not depending so much.
What isn't what removing the positive aspect?
We're saying that this obstruction that
yes.
that remove this possibility of having them
yeah.
by being rational,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So then are we painting this rational side
yeah.
as mm-hmm. bad?
Did I say it was bad?
No,
I'm just talking about logistics. It's obviously good. Everything is good. All of it's good. Everything's good. What's Rabbi Dweck's opinion on Humrah? Let's ask him. On Humrah, what from the previous parashah classes? No, I appreciate the it's meant to be respectful. I appreciate it. From the previous parashah classes, I see Humrah similar to creating your own God. That I don't know. I don't. Okay. And serving him not in the way he wants me to, but in the way I want to. Okay, it depends on what humrah we're talking about. There are humrot that are appropriate, and there are humrot that are inappropriate. The humrot that are inappropriate are, yes, I think that it's, I don't know if it's worshiping a different god, but it's certainly being consumed in one's own self-concept and not really looking, what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want from me over here? What does Torah want from me over here? Yeah. But that's another big issue. Unless I don't know what the halacha is, but that's another big issue, in my opinion. A posek dayan rabbi should be able to rule how people should respect halacha. I think that's a statement, not a question. So I'll leave that. Oh, there's more to it. Sorry. Therefore, how can I come to terms with the Yalkut Yosef's frequent hamachmir tavo ala beracha? I don't know that you have to come to terms with it. Who said you have to come to terms with it? Next question. Judaism believes in a God, Yudke Vavke. Judaism also believes in Shekhinah, divine presence. And finally, Judaism believes in Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit. Can you explain how this is different from the Christian belief in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit? Yes, I can. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit in Christianity are the Godhead, right? So they believe that these are three things that are one, that are God. We do not believe that Shekhinah and Ruach HaKodesh and Yod Kei Vav Kei are synonymous. They're not at all synonymous. Yod Kei Vav Kei is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Shekhinah is not HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not another name for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is the manifestation of relationship between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That presence, right, that relationship between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is called Shekhinah. Right? It's not just we talk about God and we talk about Shekhinah interchangeably. We do not talk about God and Shekhinah interchangeably. Shekhinah is only manifest in relationship between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it is expressive of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu within relationship between us, right? So it's not saying this is another part of God. It's not, right? It is only something that is an emergent manifestation of the relationship between Yod Kei Vav Kei and Am Yisrael. That emergent element is what we call Shekhinah. And Ruach HaKodesh has nothing to do with that at all. Ruach HaKodesh, like I said, is a person's own conscious awareness, right? That is tapping into divine levels of things. That is not synonymous with God. I hope that helps. How does the halachic system function in the post-Talmudic era? It's a question that we do not have enough time to answer. When there is multiplicity of opinions, is any specific ruling binding, and what gives it authority? Bless you. Bless you again. Should we strive to hedge our bets and cover all opinions? No. We should not strive to hedge our bets and cover all opinions because you have nothing there. You have to be a posik, which means you have to cut. Posik means stop. Cut. There has to be a decision to make. You have to make the decisions. You have to make the decisions. How we make the decisions requires a scholar. Right? A person needs to not only know the information that has to do with any particular question of the law, but also has to be able to know how to decide on the law. And there are guidelines with regards to that. So no, we shouldn't hedge our bets. And if you don't know how to do it, then you need to ask somebody that you trust who does know how to do it. That's it. That's what the Gemara means by Emunat Hachamim. Emunat talks about Emunat Hachamim. That you have a faith. You have a faithful relationship with a Hacham who knows how to do it, right? If you don't know all the information, find somebody who does, who you trust, and ask them. And that's what you do. You trust them and you ask them. But other than that, do we consider as anything binding? That's beyond what I think I can answer in the time that we have. I apologize. But it's an important question. And the truth of the matter is, if I'm not mistaken, the Chabura has a great deal on this, right? So if you look at our archives and you look at the shiurim that have been given by, you know, Rabbi Faur. I certainly have given shiurim on this. There's others that have given. Rabbi Berdugo has given shiurim on this. I really encourage you to you know, mine the archives of the Chabura, because I think we've dealt with this in toto. The next question: can we consider glazed dishes the same as glass dishes? They do not absorb flavor. I personally believe that we can. I don't say that. I mean, I've just said it publicly. But I normally don't rule that way on my own initially, right? But if somebody asks me, depending on circumstance, I will say oftentimes I will be lenient with it. And Rabbi Yitzhak Abadi held this way and was posek this way publicly. And I think that there's very substantial reason to hold this way, especially because the glaze is essentially glass, right? The glaze is essentially glass. So they say, well, but it's kli cheres. It's really not kli cheres. Kli cheres was kli cheres because it was massively porous and couldn't be fixed. So I'm not noheg this way in my own house. I'm in hag is not to do this, because from very, very early on, my family and I, and when I was younger and so on, we treated it as not to be koshered on Pesach, even though it doesn't require koshering if it's glass. We didn't use it. Hacham Avadia didn't like the psak of Rabbi Abadi, but that's mainly because Hacham Avadia didn't want to change what people are very, very used to with regards to that. But I think that a person who wants to treat it like glass has definitely what to rely on. How can we reinstate Semicha? Second to last question. How can we reinstate Semicha? Do you have a vision on how we could potentially rebuild the Sanhedrin? I do not. I do not, unfortunately. Well, I wish I did, but I don't. If I did, I would try. And the final question is, what are some concrete steps that we Jews can take to, if not perfect, at least diminish the amount of magical, mystical, and otherwise pagan or non-Jew? I don't think those are equivalent. I don't think magical or mystical is equivalent to pagan. It's a very, very big difference. Or otherwise non-Jewish, also not equivalent, non-Jewish influences, which permeate Judaism. I really have only one answer to that. Read Harambam. I mean, just study Harambam. Read Harambam, become baki, an expert in Harambam, become well-read in Harambam, use him as your source for all things. And one of the amazing things is that Harambam wrote on everything. There's essentially no part of Judaism that Harambam did not speak eloquently and clearly and deeply about in one of his, if not all of his writings. So really, that is genuinely, genuinely bona fide answer. Study Harambam. And if you do, you will find yourself, if you take him seriously, if you take Harambam seriously and you take him as your teacher, not as an opinion, if you take Harambam as your teacher, as your Rav, and you follow him and you believe him and you accept what it is that he says, you will find automatically that all of these things that you're worried about will suddenly disappear from your whole relationship to Torah and Zvot and your Jewish life. Okay, right on the dot. Very good. Good? Okay. Scooby too. Good night.
Thank you, Rabbi Rosh Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov. Do we have minyan?